Hello and welcome back to another episode of Farewell. I'm your host, Clay Skipper. I'm joined by Steve Magnus and Brad Stahlberg. I've just come back from a 10-day silent meditation retreat, so I hope my voice box is working correctly and you guys can hear me. But if I'm not speaking well on today's episode, just know that it's because this is I'm transitioning back into the outside world here. We will have more about that in the coming weeks. I'm still a little bit shell-shocked, but I'm hoping to reflect on what happened and share some of that stuff with you, the listeners. So keep an eye out for that. But today we are going to do a little bit different version of our roundtable, which is instead of tackling one broad topic, we wanted to help build a toolbox that we hope will be helpful for you all. So we talk a lot about tips and things we've learned and tools we have for dealing with the sort of big pillars that we talk about most often at the Growth Equation, things like physical health, mental health, work, mastery, resilience, peak performance, all these things. And so we thought today we could just go around and do a quick hit of some of our favorite tried and true practices or habits or tools that we have learned or picked up over the years and that have, you know, sort of stood the test of time. So let's start with exercise, working out, physical health. I am curious what you guys have found as like one of your best tried and true practices or tools in that space.
You know, my number one tip for anybody is just get out the door. And I think this is so applicable because it applies to me now when I'm a washed up, trying to not injure myself runner. And when I was running, you know, 100 miles a week, which is there are days where you just wake up and you're like, this is miserable. I don't want to get it done. I'm just going to sit on this couch, or now as a dad, you know, do something that is productive and helpful. But inevitably, if you can just get yourself out the door and just kind of bargain with yourself and say, hey, I know I had that hour run, that 45 minute run, that 30 minute run scheduled. You know what? I'm just going to make it down the street. And what inevitably happens 99.9% of the time is if you get out the door, you're going to do the whole thing or most of the thing. So I literally just bargain with myself to death and do whatever I can to get myself started, and the rest takes care of itself.
How many days would you say you, when you get out the door, you're like, okay, you know what? I don't have it today. What percent of the time?
I mean, it's like never. I mean, I should say, the bargaining changes. So once you're out the door, the hard part is kind of done, in the sense you've already changed, you're dressed, you put your shoes on. You're just like, well, it's kind of a waste to walk back inside. So you're going to do something. Now, there is a decent amount of time where I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do that hard workout because I don't have it today. I'm just going to go for an easy jog or recovery run or whatever have you. That occurs. You know, maybe, I don't know, 10% of the time. Yeah. But very seldom is it ever, unless it's like an injury or something like, my Achilles really hurts, I should just stop. Besides that, it's always something gets done.
I love that you characterize yourself as a washed up athlete who runs, you know, like a 5 minute mile still with ease. And running is nice for this because you can literally just go out the door. It's a little like, it takes maybe a little bit more motivation if you got to get in a car like Brad and go to the Iron Paradise. But same idea, of course. All right, Brad, what about you?
I think the other thing that I would add is separate, are you training for performance/mastery or are you training for health? Because if you're training for performance/mastery, it's like a 600-pound deadlift goal. A lot of the training is going to be pretty hard. And there are going to be a lot of days when I don't want to show up and train, but because I'm committed to this broader path of mastery and excellence and learning about myself along the way, I get started and I do it. If you're training for health, ideally you find something that you enjoy more often than not, where getting started isn't that hard. And for a lot of people, that is just a brisk walk. And once you've developed enough fitness where a brisk walk is too easy, you just put on a backpack with some weights in it. This is now known as rucking. And then you take that brisk walk with some weights. And I think that ideally you want to find a health practice that you can enjoy quite frequently. And then it gets easier to get started. And you could also do it with other people.
The beginning there, was that you saying that you're now going for 600 pound deadlift? Is that what I'm to understand?
I'm trying to deadlift as much weight as possible. And that's the next big round number. I will continue to do it as long as the enjoyment of the process is there. And it still is there. I'm still relatively new in the sport. It feels increasingly like swimming versus weightlifting, in the sense that now I'm not muscling my way to more weight. I'm like truly gaining a feel for the bar. And that's a really cool addictive experience. And I'm sure at some point I'll burn out on it and then I'll move on.
I mean, it's quite clear that Brad needs to go to the 10-day meditation silent retreat to find his enlightenment and not lift weights during that, so he can just be okay lifting 500 and whatever pounds. But, you know, part of me just hopes that Brad just gets stuck at like 595 pounds.
I did think about you, Brad, during this retreat, because I was like, man, Brad would be in here going insane, being like, I am losing my gains. I was saying this to you guys on the...
come on. Whoa. Time out. You're portraying me like I'm this obsessed meathead. I am not that bad. All right. I go on vacation. I don't lift weights. Come on. You guys are too much for me.
Anyway, I can tell you missed me. Anyway, my answer would be, I think, consistency over intensity. And just like a thing we've said before, and we've heard people who we've interviewed talk about, including incredible athletes like Damian Warner, who actually, because he's reigning gold medalist in the decathlon, carries the mantle of greatest athlete in the world. Not every workout needs to be like impossible. And in fact, if you make every workout impossible, you're less likely to be consistent. And so I think we all touched on consistency in some form or other. The other thing I would say, going back to what you were saying, Brad, about you'll continue to do it as long as you enjoy the process, just like finding something that brings you joy, no matter if you reach the desired result, right? I mean, running for me, like I love to enter races and whatnot, but if I didn't hit my goal, or if I didn't even run any races, the fact that I do a 12-week or a 16-week training block, like most of the learning is in the training, right? And then you obviously going to learn something on race day, but the fact that even if the race got canceled, again, I'd be bummed, or the race didn't go the way I want it to go, or I get injured and I can't do it, I still will have enjoyed most of the runs along the way and learned a lot doing them. So,
and I want to harp on something I said, because I think it's important here. Separate, if you're training for performance or mastery, then there has to be an expectation that it's going to be hard. And a part of like what you're getting out of it is the ability to be consistent, to do hard things, even though Steve no longer does hard things. But he did write a book called Do Hard Things. You don't train anymore, Steve. You're making a face.
Do soft things.
Right.
So, hold on.
The animosity on this podcast is great. It falls apart. I go away for 10 days and you guys are completely fighting like a divorced couple.
Steve's ribbing on me for being too into strength training, and we can't convince Steve to sign up for the neighborhood turkey trot. He won't race because he doesn't want to train. He even said hard is too hard.
But that's because training for maximum performance is too hard for me right now. But you're not training for maximum performance, Brad. If you really cared about deadlift, you would be doing a lot more than you would right now. Like my training, the training that I'm doing right now is equivalent of what you're doing during deadlift. But like one of us has experience training as an elite athlete and the other has not. So like me training at 60 to 70%, you know, this is why I can still, as Clay pointed out, just go cruise a 5-minute mile whenever I feel like it, because like I still do hard enough things. And if you want me to, I can still go to the absolute well. I do it about once a year just to remind myself that I can, unlike Brad. So let's put this in, you know, in comparison here. We gotta add context here.
Brad, you want to respond or you want to walk away from this conversation?
I mean, he pulled out the 401 miler elite athlete card. What am I supposed to do? I pitched a near card. I pitched a pure near perfect game in eighth grade and got the game ball.
Wow. That's pretty good. How far off were you from perfect game?
It was a one hit, one walk game. We won 1-0.
Oh, wow.
It was the nice. North Farmington West Bloomfield League Championship. I've done elite sport too, Steve. I know what it's like.
Eating, diet, nutrition. We're so twisted up in this world about how to eat. What's something you've learned there that you feel like you wish you'd known sooner or that has just been really helpful to you?
Yeah, this could be an entire episode in and of itself because it is a twisted world when it comes to diet and nutrition. I think there are two guiding principles that I have for thinking about nutrition in general, and then that leads to my tool, if that's what we're going to call it. So what are the two guiding principles? The first is that obsessing over food can very quickly spiral into disordered eating. And it can also come to mirror a cult or a zealot religion. Matt Fitzgerald wrote a great book called Diet Cults, where essentially he outlines that so many of the popular diets have very little to do with the nutrients and everything to do with identity. So if you're not looking for a sense of belonging and identity, and you want to steer clear of disordered eating, the first rule that I'd have is whatever structure you come up with should not be too rigid. The second rule, which sounds totally contradictory to the first, is that if you just go with the flow in today's current food environment, you are going to be obese. I think that unless you have a brain that just has inherited like zero craving for food, it's just impossible. Like I was telling my friend the other day, like, I am quite fit. I'm sure many people have a much harder time than me, but the amount of willpower it takes living in North Carolina to not just become morbidly obese is enormous because I love Bojangles and Popeyes and Arby's and Hardee's and Cookout and on and on and on. So both of these things can be true at the same time. That diet culture is bad. Disordered eating is bad. Having way too rigid food rules and making it like a religious zealotry is generally not good. And you can't just go with the flow. So then the question becomes, well, how do you operate somewhere in the middle of those two extremes? And what has worked for me is essentially to set a menu of things that I eat every day for breakfast and every day for lunch. And there's about three options on each of those things. And I rotate throughout the three. And then dinner, we eat as a family, we eat the same meal, but my wife and I are on the same page about kind of like what the menu for dinner is. What are the staples of dinner? And then we release from that on the weekends and we get pastries, we order in, we go out to eat. And I'm just mindful that, hey, like I don't want to eat so much that I feel sick the next morning. And that is how I navigate the food environment. Now, people might be like, that still sounds fairly broad. So I'll go into detail. For dinner, what does that mean? It means a lean protein, some sort of whole food starch, brown rice, white rice, baked potato, carrots, mixed vegetables, and then generally like some kind of fruit. That could be, you know, again, that dinner could be salmon, it could be chicken, it could be ground turkey, but it's like lean protein, starch, vegetable, and then maybe some kind of fruit. And then on the weekends, those menus get released.
That to me sounds like almost the 80-20 rule. Like concentrate on like 80% eating pretty much what you call quote unquote healthy, and 20% like is the sort of slack that allows you to maintain the 80%. Let yourself like indulge a little bit.
I actually utilize something similar to Brad, but I think it's really important that our environment is rigged against us. So do your best to rig your environment for you. So for example, grew up in Houston, fast food all over the place. In high school, I said, you know what? There's some really bad fast food places. I'm just not going to eat at most of them.
You don't know what you're missing out on elite athletes, Steve.
So like, you know, the McDonald's, Taco Bell, Burger King, all those things like I haven't had since I was, I don't know, 15. And I just keep that streak going. Now I do eat fast food, but I look at the, you know, not the worst options. It's like the next ones down. So the Chipotles or whatever have you, burrito places, fast pizza places, et cetera. So I think that's really important, but that also applies to, you know, your house is use your environment to help you make the snacks really hard to get, right? Make the stuff that you should consume easier to get. So often with like the candy that we have, because like we're like everybody, it's, you know, on a top shelf in the corner where you have to kind of work to get it versus like, you know, the relatively healthy, simple granola or bar is in the cabinet where you can say, okay, I'm hungry, I'll just grab this. And then along with that, you know, and this ties into what Brad said for diet. I know nutritionists don't recommend this, but I think it works for me. So figure out what works for you. Is I eat practically the same thing for breakfast and lunch every day. And it minimizes the decisions because like, I know I'm going to have, you know, I'm going to have some granola for breakfast. For lunch, I'm going to have, you know, a turkey and cheese sandwich with some fruits or, and maybe a couple vegetables. And that's it, you know, most of the time, unless we go out to eat. And I think what that does is it gives you flexibility in your dinner to vary it up. But it also keeps me from like, you know, going and whatever, having cinnamon rolls every day for breakfast.
Yeah, that's, I like the idea in terms of designing your environment for success. I don't love, like, as Brad said, strict rules necessarily. And so this is, but one that I do like that, or one sort of phrase that I like that gets tossed around is like, it's much easier to say no to something once in the grocery store than it is to say no to it every time you go to your pantry. And I, it's like a little bit of a strict idea, but I do, but I, cause like, obviously it's nice to eat things that we like, and it's okay to indulge in some of that stuff. As Brad was saying, like, you have to allow yourself to go off the menu sometimes, but I do think that's kind of, I have found for me, like, I know my willpower is not that strong. And so if I'm like, all right, I really don't want to eat ice cream, the best thing I can do is just like deal with the anxiety in the store of like, I want it, and saying no, as opposed to having to say no every time I open the freezer. So that's one that I've found helpful.
I think something else that like we need to disclose here for listeners, and especially new listeners that might not know us as well, is physical activity is also just an enormous part of all of our lives. And again, I'm sure nutritionists wouldn't say this, but we're not nutritionists, and I'm not implying that you should like get an exercise addiction so that you can exercise so much that so you can eat whatever you want. That is not a healthy way to live. And if you're a really physically active person, like, thermodynamics are thermodynamics. You burn more fuel, more energy, and then you need more energy to maintain health. So yeah, I actually do eat a fair amount of potato chips when I'm training hard because I'm training hard. So I think it's also like, again, within the whole context of your life, where does nutrition fit in? And then all of this is also overlaid against your own personal values, because you know, here's what we know about body fatness. Excess body fatness is associated with early disease, early death, and early loss of function. However, someone could have a value set that says there is so much delicious food in so many award-winning restaurants that I would rather be here for 60 good years than 80 good years. But during those good years, just live life. And a big part of that for me is eating food.
I think I would just say, like, really work, like, experiment and work to understand what your body needs. Because I think, for just speaking personally, I for a long time was caught up in certain diet culture ideas. Like, when I started really running more seriously and like training for marathons, I would eat like a lot of salads and stay away from sandwiches, because I'd always thought like salads are healthy, quote unquote, and sandwiches are unhealthy. And I was like super undernourished because I just didn't have enough carbs. All the roughage was like really hard on my stomach. And it wasn't until I like started eating what I considered, quote unquote, more bad food, like eating more sandwiches with like meat and protein, that my body actually felt better and had the proper nutrition to do what I was asking it to do. And similarly, like, I had, whenever I'm training in a big training block, I have like intense sugar cravings and I give into those. And sometimes it's like, again, I'm using quotes, like good sugar, like fruit, but sometimes it's like candy. Like sometimes I just need simple sugars. You know, if I'm doubling up and I have like a track workout in the morning and then I'm doing a weightlifting session at night, like I just need glucose. My body wants that energy. And it took me a long time to realize, like, you should actually, it's a hard place to get there. Like I'm 34, it took me a long time to get here, but like, listen to what your body's telling you it needs. And you have to be able to delineate like when it's a real need and when it's just like, maybe you're snacking for emotional regulation, but listen to what your body needs rather than what like you read in diet culture, on the internet and in books. Cause I was steeped in that and still am very much steeped in that in a big way. So,
well, it's a good thing you found us, Clay. I may not be an elite athlete, Steve, but I know the first rule of what do you do when you're feeling flat and you're training hard? You eat more carbohydrates.
I mean, it's one of the studies that I love is on elite Kenyan marathoners who are all like 20-something marathoners. And, you know, it was something like 78% of their diet was carbs, and a very large portion of that was pure sugar because they just dump pure sugar in their tea every day.
Moving on to productivity and work. I'll start here. Mine's a little wacky. It feels adjacent or tangential, but I'll explain why I'm choosing this one. So my biggest distraction when it comes to work is my phone. Just like constantly there, constantly like have reasons to look at it. And so my tip here, and it blows my mind that people don't do this actually. Like turn off all notifications on your phone, except for ones that you absolutely need, right? So like if you have kids, you probably need to like have your phone available. If someone calls and they like, you have a missed call or voicemail, you probably want to see that red thing in the corner alerting you of that. But like, it's nuts to me that people have like their email notifications on or like have Instagram notifications on. And every time they go on their phone, they have to, again, going back to the idea of willpower, think that they can overcome the little red thing in the corner that has been specifically engineered to hijack your attention. I'm a little bit on a soapbox here, but it blows my mind that anyone would choose to leave that on their phone. And it's not just because that the phone is a distraction, but for me, it's like the more that I have less autonomy over how I use my phone, I find that it just fractures my focus. And so it's not just that I'm on my phone too much. It's that tick to want to check the notification actually ends up when I'm able to put my phone away, like rewiring my brain in such a way that it makes it harder for me to go in to do deep work, whether I'm like going through emails or trying to write intros and outros for the podcast or writing something else. It's like completely hijacks my brain. And one of the things, I still struggle with it, obviously, clearly, but one of the things that I've done that I found very helpful is just turning off notifications, and it like blows my mind that more people don't do that.
You know, I'll take you a step further, Clay, is I'm going to just advertise for this company we have no affiliation with, but this app called Brick, which comes with literally a little tiny brick. You just scan the damn thing and then it literally bricks your phone except for calls and text messages. And you can make it other things. So mine's calls, text messages, and then my Google map in case I get lost and need to go somewhere. And then it won't unbrick until you scan the thing. So you either throw the thing in the deepest recesses of your house or on the roof or wherever.
What is the thing? Sorry.
It's just like a tiny little brick that you just like scan. Like
you order it off the internet or something?
Yeah. You just order it off this company that's literally called Brick. And that's been a game changer to me because like in the morning, I just scan the thing and then I just throw the brick into the closet so that I'm not going to go rummage around for it. And then I'm good. I've got essentially a Brad's version of a burner phone, except I didn't have to pay for it because it's, you know, my own phone that all it does is act like a phone from 2005 that allows me to text and call and find my way somewhere.
Is there something, Brad, from your coaching clients that people who have like more of a quote unquote normal job that aren't creatives that you find that like a tool that a lot of them use who are working 9-to-5s that is effective?
I mean, this comes back to the recent episode we did with Cal Newport on productivity. And I think it's really just about scheduling blocks of deep focus work. And then during those blocks of deep focus work, removing your phone from the room that you're in. And if you're in the office, that might mean putting it in like a drawer or something and turning it off, turning off your email client. But it's just being deliberate about, here's the time I'm going to set aside for deep focus work. Here are the things that normally get in the way. It tends to be our phone and email. Here's how I'm going to remove those distractions. And the one thing that I would also add to that is, here are the menu of 2 to 5 things that I'm going to allow myself to work on in that deep focus block. Because otherwise, what can happen with my clients is they've got an hour and a half on their schedule for deep focus work, and then it just turns into like an hour and a half of catching up on their email. So you have to know ahead of time what you're going to work on, or at least give yourself some options of more nourishing, enriching projects that you want to move the ball down the field on.
Yeah, and I would say for some of that stuff, I mean, I'm speaking a little bit out of turn because I haven't worked in a typical office environment for a couple of years since I was at GQ. But I think I've heard people say, and again, this depends on how much autonomy you have, where you are in the sort of corporate hierarchy, but it's like, if you have work you need to get done and you want to do a deep work period, like, schedule that in your calendar.
Yeah.
Because every time a meeting gets set, that's like time that's locked in. And people are like, okay, they look at your calendar and they respect that. Like 1:30, 2:30, we've got this like meeting, and they're not going to mess with that because that's sort of how the office culture works. So if you throw a block in your calendar from 2:30 to 4 and people aren't, you know, narking on you and looking at what that block is for, people are going to respect that. And you can then hold that time, I think, is a good way to think about that.
I'd go a step further. And if people are narking on you, just say, like, meeting on XYZ project. And that's just a meeting with yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
And then the last thing I'd say is, we talk a lot about deep work because we are writers, podcast hosts, and our entire job is deep focus work. Like, that is our biggest asset, is getting really good at that. If you are a nurse on a Florida hospital or a first grade teacher, this might not be core to your job, and that's okay. So I think it's also like asking yourself, hey, is my job predominantly one where the core competency is deep focus work, or is it more of an operator where my job is to like keep doors open and closed and keep things running smoothly and deal with what's coming up in front of me? And even for people who don't fall clearly into one of those buckets, it could be a season of work. So if you're like a manager at a big company, there are seasons where you've hired new people, you're building a team, and your job is very much like that nurse on the floor, where you're just responding to things, you're just being available for your team. Then there are other new seasons where you're going to launch a strategic initiative. And as a manager, you got to protect your time so you can actually think about what you're going to do. So I think it like always starts at, what am I actually trying to get done in this season of my life? What is the core function of my job? And then where does deep work fit in? And if you're writing a book like me, it's going to be 2 blocks by 2 hours. In a season where I'm not writing a book, it's just going to be 1 block. For, again, I go to the most extreme example, for the charge nurse on the floor, there's going to be no blocks of deep work because that's not his job.
Anxiety, this is a big bucket, but sort of like anxiety, how to deal with anxiety, or rough mental health days. We are the OCD boys, which I should say that we say that sort of in jest, but we only say it in jest because we have all very much struggled with it in a real way. So we're not making light of it. Something that we are all well versed in, these obsessional loops. And I'm curious what you guys have developed, what tools here you have that are helpful. I'll go first. And this goes back a little bit to like work and productivity. And goes back to an interview I actually did with you, Brad, when I was working at GQ, which is, you told me once that like you just need to get comfortable with the fact that like a lot of what you're trying to get done in a day is not going to get done and is going to fall through the cracks. And a lot of what happens to me at the end of the day is like, I look at my to-do list and I'm probably not the best at making to-do lists. I'm not like doing the 3 top tasks and then pulling something in, but I look at my to-do list, am I going to get everything done? And that anxiety like really radiates. And especially if I'm falling behind throughout the course of the day, it can make it hard for me to like keep going and have momentum. And I think just like accepting the anxiety that not everything is going to get done and some things are going to fall through the cracks. And as long as you are properly prioritizing what matters most, that can be okay. like as I've gotten older and done more and more, I've just realized like, oh, if something falls through the cracks, it's not the worst thing in the world, and that's okay. And so for me, it's not so much managing that anxiety as just like recognizing that anxiety is there and we all have too much to do and we're all overwhelmed, and it's actually okay to like just sit with that anxiety. That would be my takeaway.
And I think that, so you just shared that really nicely in a work context or like a to-do list context. And what I would say is that the same thing is true even if the source of your anxiety is not just about, did I not get through my to-do list or I have so much to do? But even if it is the most typical but bizarro, like clinical anxiety obsessional loop. So, you know, was that a speed bump earlier or did I just hit a person and I got to go back and check 10 times? Well, what does the evidence say for managing that kind of obsessional loop is you just sit with it. Like you don't go back and check. And the more that you try to make anxiety go away by reassuring yourself or by actively trying to make yourself feel better, the worse it gets. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to do things in life that like support sound mental health, but that does mean that like you can't talk yourself out of feeling anxious. So it's just like, oh, I'm feeling really anxious right now. I'm going to just keep going about my day and doing the things that I said I was going to do. I'm not going to let this anxiety change my behavior and I'm going to take it along for the ride. I think that for 98% of circumstances that works. And then there's the 2% when it's so paralyzing that you should seek help from a therapist, psychiatrist, some combination of the two. But I guess like the biggest thing I'd say is, all right, I guess we've kind of already gone off the rails a little bit. So there are certain podcast hosts that have all of these tools, you know, the psychological or the physiological arousal, what do they call it? Inhale, exhale, snort, breathing.
Physiological sigh, Brad. Come on.
Physiological sigh. I don't know. All this bullshit that these people that are not therapists, they are not schooled in mental health, proclaim for dealing with anxiety. And I'll tell you what, if you are in the biathlon and you need to calm down really fast to try to like shoot the target after you just sprinted or ran really hard to get there, yeah, those tools are going to be great. But if you're someone with generalized anxiety disorder, the worst thing that you can do is try to have some quick fix that's going to make you calm down in the moment. Because all that's going to happen is your brain is going to throw up another what if, and you're not going to calm down. And then you're going to be even more despaired because the 3-hour podcast on how to breathe through your nose didn't work for your anxiety. And what I wish more people would understand is access to evidence-based therapy, which then would teach you that you've got to be really kind to yourself because being a human is hard. There's so much fucking stuff in this world to genuinely be anxious about. And you've got to be there and have your own back and be kind to yourself and just sit with those hard feelings and hopefully build some like loving support around you to help you. And that is how you get through anxiety. It's not magnesium before bed. It's not athletic greens. It's not any of these bullshit breathing exercises. It's just not. Like the only way through anxiety is through, and the only way you get through is by releasing from the need to fix and being really kind to yourself because it's hard.
I disagree with you on the breathing to some extent. I think some of the breathing
can help.
Like box breathing can help.
You just came from a 10-day meditation retreat where all you did was focus on your breath. And you told me the last 3 days were one giant panic attack. So how does that work?
I survived.
Let me get down. Let me bring some nuance to Brad's, you know, BS calling. Here's how I like to delineate it. If your feeling of anxiety is related to a concrete thing, such as performance, if I'm getting ready to go to the starting line, the tools can work because the thing is concrete. You know, if I get to the start of the race, I'm going to be okay, right? The gun goes off, the anxiety will dissipate because you've turned into action. You're getting ready to go up to the speech. As soon as you start that first, you know, slide that you've done over and over, the anxiety will dissipate to a degree because you've started. The tools, the breathing, the exercises, the distraction, those are the things you pull out in those moments. I'll tell you, as a coach, I've used all of them. I've used a physiological sigh with people because you tell people stuff who are freaking out in their head. You give them something to do that often allows you to, again, tampen things down a little bit, sometimes real, sometimes imagined, but it gets you to the starting line. So I think that's really important. The other half of it is what I would call, you know, Brad would call generalized anxiety. I would call anxiety without a clear endpoint or thing that is like contributing to it. And I think there is where Brad is getting at of like the short-term fixes probably won't work because, like, you know, what we resist persists, what we distract comes back 10 times harder if there's no endpoint. Or there's uncertainty around it. And I think that's where it's like more traditional therapies or, you know, just stuff that we talk about all the time with OCD is like creating space between like your thoughts and feelings and like understanding that, hey, like I feel this, I experience this, that's okay. I can't push it away. It's gonna be there. But if I just kind of sit with it for a while, eventually it's gonna, you know, be at a manageable place and I'm not going to reinforce it. And I think those two distinctions are really important. And I think Brad's point is we don't make those distinctions too often. And often we just treat everything as if it's like getting ready for race day. And if I just have these tools, I'll get to the starting line. And that's often not the case.
An even easier way to think about it, because maybe some people with generalized anxiety have found relief in some of these tools, is if the tool works, use it. But if it doesn't, don't stress. Just be like, this is a stupid tool. It's not going to work for what I have. I got to go a level deeper. And that level deeper, to Steve's point, is generally acceptance. And with the help of a therapist, most people tend to get there faster.
Yeah. And I like that idea too, originally, of like, you can't fix the anxiety. That was something I definitely learned on this retreat, is like, you just got to sit in it as painful as it is, and it will transform eventually. Even if it takes 3 days and 30 hours of sitting in a meditation hall by yourself and not talking to anybody and going insane. But more on that happy experience in a few weeks. For now, hopefully you guys have found some tools that some of these maybe you had, some maybe you haven't had. And I think the thing to reiterate here at the end is what Brad actually just said about like figuring out tools that work for you. So what works for us is not necessarily going to work for you, or even what works for us now may not have worked in the past and may not work in the future. So it's like an ever evolving machine that you got to figure out what works for you. So hopefully you can try to implement some of these if they're not in your practice, and you can get back to us and tell us if they're helpful or insightful or useful. And if not, send us some angry emails, clay.growtheq@gmail.com, or you can call our voicemail at 646-893-9503. We'll be back on Monday with another coach up. And yeah, hopefully you guys have a more robust toolbox than you did before you opened this episode. We will talk to you next week. Until then, as always, farewell.